And really, I'd like to start firstly by thanking our funders. So I'd really like to thank the Open Society Foundations, as well as the Oak Foundation that provided additional financial assistance for this project. The other thing I wanted to do at the start is to thank two really inspirational people that have been really involved in this project, but sadly are no longer with us. So I just wanted to take a moment to mention Annika Osse and Professor Christoph Haynes. And I know their inspiration is, their memory is an inspiration to many of us here today, I'm sure. So I just wanted to start off by acknowledging that. In terms of the event today then, in launching this report towards a lethal force monitor, we're really hoping to do a number of things. So firstly, as you'll see, this report has a particular focus on South Africa and Kenya, with a particular focus on looking at policies for recording, investigating, and publishing information on deaths following the use of force by law enforcement officials. And these case studies, which we're going to hear about, very much build on an early event that we held earlier this year in February, where we presented case studies from several Western European contexts. And the second thing I think that we're really hoping to do is to use this as an opportunity to have a broader discussion and to start having conversations about future agendas for a lethal force monitor and next steps as well. So we're hoping to address that both through some of the presentations and then through the discussions and the conversation after the presentations. So we've got a really great lineup of speakers today. So we are going to hear first from Dr. Thomas Probert from the University of Pretoria, who's going to talk and give us an overview about some of the lethal norms in the African context. Then we're going to hear from Dumisani Gandhi, also from the University of Pretoria, who's going to talk us through the South Africa case study. And then Beryl O'Rao, also from Pretoria, who's going to speak about the work in Kenya. Then we're going to hear from Professor Brian Rappert, also at the University of Exeter, who will be looking at future directions and ideas for a lethal force monitor going forward. And last but not least, we're pleased to have Professor Inácio Cano from the University of Rio de Janeiro, who's going to speak about monitoring lethal force in Latin America. And really, as I say, the plan after that then is just to open it up for questions and discussions and comments. And we're really hoping to hear from all of you. So I hope that that's all clear and everything makes sense. And so without further ado then, if I could hand over to our first speaker, Dr. Thomas Probert from the University of Pretoria. So thanks very much, Thomas.
Thank you, Abby, and thanks to the University of Exeter, both for hosting this afternoon's launch and for the invitation to us at the University of Pretoria, the Centre for Human Rights, to join you in this endeavour of the lethal force monitor, and thanks also to the Oak Foundation for the support that they provided in allowing us to participate in the research. As you mentioned, Abby, like much of the work that we find ourselves at the Centre for Human Rights kind of celebrating at the moment, we celebrate with a kind of tinge of great sadness of missing our colleague Christoph Haynes, who was deeply involved in the research that led to the two case studies that we're presenting today, and who spoke at the launch of the previous report in this series about how exciting it was to see the kind of actualization of work that he'd done at the United Nations for a number of years, kind of taking shape in the form of these reports. I thought I'd start briefly just by speaking about how this exercise kind of fits into exactly that work at the United Nations or wherever else of looking comparatively at use of force by the police, and then say something specifically about the African Union's human rights mechanism and how it fits into the context of the two examples that we're looking at. So broadly, I think that undertaking comparative analysis of use of force by the police has these kind of three dimensions. Thinking around the clarification of the norms themselves at the international level, any inconsistency that there might be between those norms and legal frameworks at national level, and then investigative challenges of establishing whether or not specific acts conformed with either the national or international standards. So at the first of those levels, you know, I think the norms around use of force by the police are relatively settled. There hasn't been a great deal of evolution of certainly the substantive norms for some time, though I think it's worth noting, you know, recently work that several of us were involved with, led by OHCHR and others in developing new guidance on less lethal weapons, did elaborate standards for the transparency of collection of data around use of force. So it's worth highlighting that you know there is movement. But at the second level, I think that analysis of disjuncture between national and international standards is a significant topic area. And that's work that we've been doing, a project led by one of my colleagues at the center, Professor Stuart Maslin. Policinglaw.info has produced a kind of a database of global legal frameworks around the use of force, which do establish at the level of the substantive and procedural norms, the extent to which the national laws are mapping onto international standards. But then in that third category of analyzing individual acts, I mean, I think that this is an exercise which is always going to become too granular to undertake detailed comparative work at a global scale. But I'm looking forward to Professor Kanu's remarks later on around how you know, we can infer information about those questions of implementation from more aggregated data. So at the African continental level, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights has, I think, for a long time been a champion of the issue of human rights and policing on the continent. This has been formalized recently by the addition of policing to the mandate of the Special Rapporteur, what had been the Special Rapporteur on prisons and conditions of detention. But I think de facto, that mandate and the Commission more broadly has been doing very laudable work in elaborating standards on policing and use of force, and indeed the procedural dimensions of the issue for some time. That's been both through cases that the Commission has decided. Last year, for example, a case against Egypt on the use of force in the context of assemblies, which underlined procedural failings. Resolutions on police accountability, on the right to life, on excessive use of force by the police, including in the context of COVID-19, and in terms of soft law guidance, perhaps most detailedly in this regard, the guidelines on policing assemblies by law enforcement officials in Africa, which really underlines the obligation that states have both to establish oversight mechanisms and the specific mandate that those mechanisms should have, namely to be capable of receiving complaints from the public, receiving mandatory reports from the police, and conducting prompt, impartial, and effective investigations into all of those incidents, and then to make public the results of those inquiries, to make recommendations, and for the state to systematically collect data around use of force, specifically in the context of assemblies, given the topic of that guideline, but I think the obligation can be understood more expansively. So at the continental level, there's a clear imperative to establish capacity to fulfill these procedural obligations of the state. We've started in this report by looking at two of the countries where I think the the institutionalization of that capacity has been most advanced in South Africa and in Kenya. But as the two examples that will now follow, I think there are still challenges even there. But I think thinking about how we can engage with those countries to make further kind of incremental improvements through comparative exercises like this is one item for our agenda. And then a question mark about how the same exercise can be used to apply pressure for much needed institutionalization and development elsewhere on the continent. So very much looking forward to the conversation to come, and I'll pass back to you, Abby.
Thanks so much, Thomas. Really interesting, and I think that nicely leads us into our next presentation then. So Dumisani, over to you, if I may, for your comments on South Africa.
Okay, without further ado, I'll move on with the South African presentation, which is, please go to the next slide, which is divided into four sections. The first one looking at the police oversight institutional arrangements, and this is the formal mechanisms. And then I'll then look at the process itself, which is, you know, how the duty to investigate is done, you know, from case intake to the judicial procedures. And the third one is looking at the data quality that comes out of that process, and then which then leads to the recommendations at the end. Next slide, please. So on this slide, in terms of the institutional arrangement, I'll start by looking at the Police Investigative Directorate, IPID. So subsequently, when I call it IPID, I mean this one. Which has the responsibility to constitutional mandate to investigate as an external investigative body police misconduct, by the, you know, South African Police Service, as well as the Metropolitan Police Service, which I did not put there. Which, you know, polices the metropolitan areas in South Africa. The mandate of the IPID is stated in Section 28 of the IPID Act, which lists types of misconduct that the IPID is supposed to investigate. And among them includes death as a result of police action, which is the focus of this presentation. As you can see, both the South African Police and the IP report to the Minister of Police, who as a member of the executive of government, then reports to Parliament for accountability. And there are issues around there regarding the independence of IP and in the sense of financial, legal, as well as policy at operational levels, where the IPID depends on the Ministry of Police for its budget. And also because the IPID is overwhelmed and understaffed, it then has to depend on the South African Police Service itself, which it's supposed to investigate in order to get support in terms of forensics, as well as investigative capacity. So it's like the South African Police Service investigating cases against its own members. So it creates a conflict of interest there. A conflict of interest as well in the sense that if the IPID performs very well, and the South African Police Service or Metropolitan Police Services don't look good, that reflects badly also on the performance of the minister. So there are those things to deal with. And there has been a constitutional challenge regarding that matter. And still, there are still issues around the fact that the Minister of Police has a say in the appointment of or the executive director of the IP, and that creates, you know, that dependability that might affect the executive director's execution of their duties from an independent perspective. These issues, I think, will come up further down when we talk about how this whole system is operationalized. Can you go to the next slide? So here, this is the process that explains how the duty to investigate works in South Africa. When there's been a death, it triggers then an investigation. And when this comes in two ways for the case intake, the police, when they've, through their actions, led to a death, the police are obliged under Section 29 of the IPID Act to report to IPID so that they initiate investigations. And this applies to both the South African Police Service and the Metropolitan Police Service. There can also be complaints about death as a result of police action from anyone, basically, to report to IP. But in this case, because there's a death, it's normally the police that self-report these deaths to IP. And IPID then initiate the investigation. I think in the first 72 hours, their service standard is that, you know, this death must be logged in their case management system. It must be classified according to the types of issues that IPID must investigate. An investigator must be allocated. And then subsequently, the investigator must then get any evidence from the officers involved that relates to that death, which includes affidavits, their statements regarding what happened. Then the investigator must then attend a postmortem for each death and collect witness statements where there are witnesses. And then this information is put together into a docket, an investigative docket, which is ideally supposed to reach a decision-ready status, which means that the investigator who has been allocated the case has thoroughly done his or her investigation and has sufficient evidence to either send the docket to the National Prosecuting Authority for criminal prosecution or to send it back to SAPS recommending disciplinary action against the officers involved. Thirdly, it might be that the complaint is not substantiated, especially if it's coming from a non-police, I think, complainant. With the National Prosecuting Authority, this then is taken to court. If the National Prosecuting Authority thinks that there's a strong case to prosecute, and then a guilt and sentencing is then determined by the court or the officers alleged to have committed the crime are acquitted. But sometimes the National Prosecuting Authority then, if the case is not strong enough, they refer it back to they refer it back to IPID. And then there's the disciplinary procedure process as well. All these things are then evaluated by the secretariat, by the Civilian Secretariat for Police for learning processes. Next slide. On the data publication and analysis, the information about death as a result of police action is published annually by the IPIT in its annual report, and it's normally a simple count of these deaths, and it's normally outputs oriented. For example, I use the 2017-2018 report of the IPIT to just illustrate what kind of information they provide. So there's a cumulative information of all everything that is reported for all categories. And then there's the annual incidence of death as a result of police action. In this case, there were 436 incidents, resulting in 558 deaths. This is divided in terms of which agency committed was involved in the killing. And normally it's 98% of SAPs. They also look at the service standards that I was referring to. To what extent are they adhering to them? And then the death scenes attended and so on. I think you can see from the list of information that is given there, the kinds of information that you find in this report. If there are questions, we'll discuss them during discussion time. I'll go to the next slide, which looks at the recommendation. So there were three broad recommendations with the sub-recommendations. In terms of detection and investigation of cases, the report recommends that because the IPD is understaffed and under-resourced, it requires to be sufficiently funded or to focus on, to prioritize certain cases by then offloading some of the investigations back to the police where there are minor issues. With the death as a result of police action being the competence of IPIT to investigate. There's need also to enhance the independence of IPIT, which increased resources helps, but also perhaps take the format of other similar institutions, which are referred to as Chapter 9 institutions, that don't report to a minister or a member of the executive in government. They report straight to parliament. It can also be improved by shifting towards impact and outcome effectiveness instead of just listing the numbers without, processing them. The second one regards the public reporting of cases. IPIT could enhance its transparency by reporting more information on the dates. Death as a result of police action, including demographic and also contextual information around how those deaths happened, so that the report is more informative in terms of the context of death as a result of police action. They could also increase the frequency of communications about specific cases. In terms of institutional policy response, there needs to increase proactive oversight in terms of learning from its investigations and by providing independent research and analysis that can inform how they can reform the reporting of cases. I think I'll end it there so that we can go to the next presenter.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Damasani. That was great. And just to say, please do feel free to put questions or comments or anything like that in the chat while people are speaking as well. Okay, so next then, if we can pass over to Beryl, who's going to very kindly speak to the Kenya case study.
Thank you very much, Abby, and thanks to everyone for joining us in this launch. So if you could move to the next slide, please. Right, so I'll start by briefing you about the institutional arrangement for policing in Kenya. So we have the National Police Service, which is established under the Constitution of Kenya. And the National Police Service consists of the Kenya Police Service, which focuses on public security and safety. And then there is the Administration Police Service, which focuses on border security and protection of critical infrastructure. And then the Directorate of Criminal Investigations, which focuses on investigation of serious crime. So there are a number of institutions that exercise oversight over the police in Kenya. And the primary one is the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, which I'm henceforth going to refer to as IPOA. So IPOA was established in 2012, and it's a civilian oversight body. And then the National Police Service also has an internal oversight mechanism, and that is the Internal Affairs Unit. Aside from that, there are also other institutions. Key among them, I would say, is the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights, which by virtue of its mandate to enhance the promotion and protection of human rights, also exercises oversight over the police. Next, please. Yeah, so in terms of data collection on deaths from police action, the official agency that does that is the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, that's IPOA. And there's actually a legal obligation on the part of the police to report every incident involving a death to IPOA. So how does it generate its data? One, as I've said, from notifications from the National Police Service. And then it also receives complaints from members of the public. And it may also note such incidents through media reports or through referrals by other state agencies and or non-governmental organizations. And whenever it becomes aware of an incident involving a death, IPOA conducts investigations, which it can do either on its own motion or on the basis of a complaint received from a member of the public. So those investigations are to some extent independent, but also very dependent on the National Police Service in the sense that for technical expertise, for example, for ballistics examinations, they will normally rely on the Directorate of Criminal Investigations. So to that extent, there's hence the conclusion that IPOA is partially independent in terms of its investigations. And then once IPOA has concluded its investigations, it normally, depending on the finding that it has made, it will forward either conclude that no violation was established or forward the investigation file to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions, which will then determine whether to proceed with the prosecution or not. And then the information that IPOA gathers through the means that I've just explained, it publishes in its periodic reports, but the information it shares is mostly just numbers, statistics on how many complaints they receive or how many complaints touching on deaths that they receive. But what they publish does not have adequate information on the circumstances of those deaths. And then again, they also don't publicly share the investigation reports. And aside from that, in terms of how many cases they forwarded to the ODPP, which ended up in a prosecution, it's a bit difficult to tell because in their periodic reports, you'll note there are differences in the numbers from one reporting period to the next. One could be higher than the next, but there's normally no explanation for that difference. So hence the conclusion that their records of prosecution are unclear. They share information on the number of convictions, but not information on acquittals or discharges. Next slide, please. Yeah, so given what I've just shared, we concluded that IPOA's records, or generally the data on deaths following police action in Kenya, are unreliable for several reasons, some of which I have listed there. And one is that the National Police Service itself does not record such incidents. And if they do, then they don't share them at all with the public. And again, the National Police Service doesn't comply with its obligation to notify IPOA about any incident involving a death. And that means IPOA misses out on a lot of information concerning such incidents. Now, given the failure by the National Police Service to notify IPOA, you would expect that IPOA can still get that information from the public if the public reports. But the ability of the public to report is again limited by issues of access. So IPOA has 9 offices in the country, one in the headquarters in Nairobi, and the others 8 regional offices. So against a total population of 49 million people, I would say there's very limited physical access to IPOAS offices by members of the public. And that means, again, they miss out on critical information concerning deaths following police action. In relation to the information that they have received, the data they have collected, either through notifications or through receipt of complaints from members of the public, we noted some inconsistencies in how they report on those deaths. So for example, in one report, IPOA presented data on deaths from police shootings, excuse me, and then in another one, it presents data on deaths from police actions. So in a context where it presents data on deaths from police shootings, it's unsafe to conclude that in that particular reporting period, the only reports on deaths that they received were those that concerned shootings. And then there's also some ambiguity in how they report on deaths in custody. So some deaths can occur in custody, which may not necessarily be attributed to actions of the police, but then there are also deaths that occur in custody as a result of use of force incidents. There is no distinction in how they report on these deaths, on whether or not the death in custody was as a result of the actions of a law enforcement official. And then lastly, we also noted that not all the complaints they receive are investigated. So for example, in one reporting period, they received a total of 1,133 complaints, 78 of which were on deaths from police action and 27 on deaths in custody. They investigated 99 cases, which I assume include other cases of violations by police officers, which don't necessarily involve deaths. So in the absence of information on whether all the reports they received concerning deaths were actually verified, then it becomes a bit difficult to conclude that the information they have is accurate. Next, please. Right, thanks, Abby. Next. Okay, let me just move to the next slide. In the next slide, I'm comparing official and non-official sources. So aside from IPOA, there are also other non-official sources of data. And the one that I singled out is the Nation Database, which is a media source, and it's the most regularly updated. So you can see that in 2018, IPOA reported 89 cases, the Nation reported 250. And then in the subsequent year, IPOA had more than the Nation. And those variations are quite common, and they just go to illustrate that the data that is available is generally inaccurate. And next, please. On the recommendations. So having said that, some of the recommendations we made, one concerning the official detection and investigation of cases, we recommend that IPOA and the National Police Service need to strengthen their notification protocols. In particular, the National Police Service needs to comply with its obligation to notify IPOA about any incident involving deaths. And then there is also need to operationalize the Coroner Service Act, which establishes the Office of the Coroner General, who will also be involved in the investigation of cases involving deaths, and which can also act as a source of data for IPOA. And then to ensure that as many members of the public as possible know about IPOA, its mandate, and what to do whenever they encounter situations where there has been a death, IPOA needs to enhance its public outreach, and in particular focus on rural areas, focus beyond urban areas. Then in terms of publication of the data, they need to resume regular publication of their performance report, which they have been doing regularly for a long time until 2019, when for some reason they stopped uploading them in their website. So for purposes of transparency and public scrutiny, it's important for them to make them public. And then they also need to standardize reporting on deaths, be more precise in the language they use. And then in addition to the periodic reports that they have, which address various issues concerning interactions between the public and the police, it would also be ideal for IPOA to have a dedicated report that has statistics on the number of deaths in a given period resulting from police action. And lastly, on institutional changes, it's important for IPOA to monitor and report on the implementation of their recommendations that they have made to the National Police Service concerning deaths resulting from police action. And then to all stakeholders, IPOA, National Commission on Human Rights, and civil society actors, it's also necessary for them to increase awareness on incidents of death resulting from use of force by other law enforcement agencies like Kenya Forest Service and Kenya Wildlife Service, which also needs to get to the attention of IPOA and which would also contribute to the data we have on deaths from police action. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Beryl. That was really interesting. And so what we want to do now then is, building on those two case studies that we've heard, is just to take a step back and look really at an agenda for the future and next steps with a lethal force monitor more broadly. And for that, I'm going to hand over to Brian Rappert, who's going to say a few words in that regard.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, Abby. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. So we've heard a summary of the case reports for South Africa and Kenya, and the report that we're launching today follows on from a report that we launched earlier in the year, looking at four countries in Western Europe at their practices. So why are we doing all this? We're doing all this because we think there needs to be a global force monitor for lethal force associated with police actions. The OECD, for instance, has lots of international reports it comes out with about education, skills, employment, these kinds of issues. Transparency International has an index that it runs about corruption. Okay, but there isn't anything comparable in relationship to police lethal force. And this is what we're trying to build through our various efforts and the reports that we've done to date. So looking ahead, what needs to be done? Well, to kind of think through this process, just to say a little bit about what has been done so far. What we've been focusing on in these two reports are really the practices and procedures in place for accountability of police agencies. So you've heard some of the issues, the report goes into them in much more detail, these kind of five areas that we've looked at here: availability, what's collected and published, the quality, our lessons learned, and what kind of investigations take place. But if we're to think about a lethal force monitor and what might be done, there's other components that are necessary too. We need to talk about the legal frameworks, which we've done a little bit in these reports, but we need to do a little bit more in terms of building a systematic monitor. And in some nations, especially those nations without organizations that are tasked with oversight of these, there needs to be ways of counting how many fatalities are associated with police use of force. Right? We have fairly reliable figures for those within the jurisdictions that we looked at. But once you start moving out of those jurisdictions, those jurisdictions with oversight mechanisms, the situation becomes much more complex. And I think we're going to hear about all three of these levels when we get to our final presentation about Latin America. But in any case, what we're seeking to do now is to build this lethal force monitor, to get different regions, academics, NGOs, others collaborating to be able to build up something that looks broadly, okay, not just at specific countries, but over the whole globe, really. In the report, we set out some of the principles we think that are important in underpinning any kind of lethal force monitor. I mean, I can just briefly speak to those now, but I mean, you can read those in the report, right? On the one hand, we want to provide shared international standards by which we can have comparisons. On the other hand, we need to think about how to build in flexibility. So these are one of the issues we have to deal with. With any kind of exercise like this, it's important to think about the assumptions that are driving it. And in this latest report, we identify some of the assumptions we think are very important: that every death be recorded, recognized, and investigated; that lessons be learned, right? I mean, I guess, at least, in terms of rhetoric and so on, I mean, there's widespread international agreement about those matters. One of the other things we talk about is the importance of meaningful engagement of surviving family members. Now, again, I mean, in the countries that we've looked at so far, there's been a lot of discussion on that point, but maybe practice has fallen a little short of the aspirations. But also, we think it's very important that law enforcement agencies and others also think about some of the limitations of existing standards and laws. How can they be improved? Okay, so these are some of the things we want to think about when we're talking about clarity. Inclusion, I mean, to date, the work that we've done, we've tried to engage in a comparative approach across the countries that we've been investigating. You know, a lot of that has been driven just by us as analysts, as researchers who are concerned about issues about police use of force. If we want to build a proper monitor, we need to seek, the views of various stakeholders on what we should be looking at, the criteria, how we should be doing the judgments, and so on. And then just as a final couple of points, the report also talks about the importance of managing personal data. I mean, this is going to be very important when we start trying to document deaths that are maybe unacknowledged. We have issues here in tune about thinking across years about how to ensure the sustainability of any actions taken. So you can look in the report, you can see some of the details around this, but these points that we're trying to look for and to ask what can be done internationally to build on what we've already done, okay, to make it more systematic, to make it wider in terms of the range of countries involved, and to make it based on more robust, let's say, benchmarking standards. Okay, so this is our overall kind of vision for what needs to be done. And we'll pass over to the next and last presenter, and we'll get a sense of how that's already taken shape in one part of the world.
Thank you, Brian. I also want to thank the University of Exeter for the invitation today. So I'll be shortly presenting the results of a similar project in Latin America and the Caribbean. Next, please. Next slide. So we are attempting to analyze indicators of use and abuse of lethal force by law enforcement agents. The legal approach is typically based on evidence for individual cases. However, the criminal justice systems in our countries are notoriously unable to prosecute and sentence abuses. And therefore, we argue for the need for an approach that assesses overall patterns rather than individual cases. We started with 5 countries in 2019. We have added 3 more now. And we have 2 sources. One is official records, which we request from the institutions. And second is press reports. And as the case of Nigeria also made very clear just now, official records are not always reliable, and therefore we decided to seek press reports in order to compare them with official records. We have developed a common methodology which allows comparison between countries. Next, please. So we calculate incidents, indicators, the number of civilians killed by on-duty public security agents, also weighted by inhabitants, the number of public security agents, people arrested, weapons seized. And we also look at the public security agents which were killed, because we believe they are closely related in many countries. And also politically, when you try to present this point to the police forces, it's important to show that you're also caring for their own. Next one, please. And then we calculate indicators of abuse of lethal force. For example, the proportion of total homicides that are due to the intervention of public security agents, the ratio between civilians killed and public security agents killed, the ratio between the number of civilians killed and the number of civilians wounded. There's some literature behind certain thresholds for these indicators so that when they overcome a certain threshold, we can assume there is an excessive use of force. Next one, please. So this is an example from 2007 in Latin America, and you can see that the data in gray are originating from the press, and the data in white, the cells in white, are originating from official data. And you can see, for example, the proportion of homicides due to state intervention, to police or army intervention, comes to 25% in the case of Venezuela, which is a staggering figure. And you can see that in El Salvador, for every police officer that is killed in duty, we have 101.8 civilians killed. So these are very clear indicators of abuse of lethal force. Next one, please. So we have three initiatives now. The University of Pretoria has done a great effort in analyzing norms and regulations. The University of Exeter is focusing now on accountability and accessibility of information. And we in Latin America are focusing on indicators of use and abuse. So I think there is a reasonable degree of convergence that could lead us one day towards a global monitor, which would cover norms, would cover accountability, and would cover actual incidents and abuse. And we have to foster global accountability and comparability for the use of force, which is limited today. Also, we should force countries to collect and disseminate data on this, which many countries do not. And we should press international organizations like UNODC, because they don't have any data on police use of force. We've had a few clashes with them, and they only count crimes. And if the homicide by a police officer is not considered a crime, it's not even reported. So I think we should also put pressure on international organizations to start collecting and disseminating these kinds of data. So again, thank you very much for the time.
That's lovely. Thank you very much, Brian, and thank you, Ignacio, for those fantastic presentations. And I think so many interesting ideas and possibilities about next steps. So I'd really like to open it up to those of you present for any questions you may have or any thoughts on kind of future agendas and future kind of directions of travel.